morning. And along with that, he makes the aspiration that all of our wisdom, which arises from listening to, reflecting on, and meditating on the teachings of the genuine Dharma, will increase and increase, and that this will result in our performing great benefit for all of the limitless number of sentient beings. To be able to come here today and to meet you all, to meet Lama Dujum Dorje and all of his students, is something that makes Rinpoche very, very happy. Before listening to the teachings, Rinpoche asks that we give rise to the precious attitude of bodhicitta, which means that for the benefit of all sentient beings who are as limitless in number as the sky is vast in its extent, we aim to attain the state of complete and perfect enlightenment. We know that in order to do that, we must listen to, reflect upon, and meditate upon the teachings of the genuine Dharma with all of the enthusiasm we can muster in our hearts. This is the precious attitude of bodhicitta. Please give rise to it and listen. Since we as sentient beings all possess the Buddha nature, the essence of enlightenment, then it is possible for us to attain the state of enlightenment should we wish to try to do so. The Buddha himself said in the sutras that the Buddha nature pervades all sentient beings. Every single sentient being has within them the cause of enlightenment. What is this Buddha nature? Well, if we analyze, if we try to find it with our intelligence, we can't find anything. Whatever we turn our intelligence to in terms of trying to find something, trying to analyze for it to see if it's there, we can't find anything at all. But resting relaxed without any analysis, once the analysis is finished, there is an experience of exquisite clarity. Beautiful and exquisite clarity that is quite open and relaxed. And this is the Buddha nature. In terms of the stages of the Buddha nature, the first stage is the Buddha nature at the time of the ground. And this is nothing other than the fundamental nature of mind, of every single sentient being. The true nature of our minds is naturally the Buddha nature. In this way, it is like the sesame butter that is always present in a sesame seed. It is like butter that is always present in milk. It is like gold that is present in a very pure form within gold ore. If we are able to gain confidence that the basic nature of our mind is this Buddha essence, that this Buddha nature is present in every single sentient being, then we will free ourselves from the discouragement that we can feel sometimes when we think, I can't do this, I can't attain enlightenment, it's something beyond my reach. Once we gain certainty that our very nature is the nature of the Buddha, we will be free from that type of feeling. And furthermore, if we are able to gain confidence in the fact that the Buddha nature is present equally in every single sentient being, then this will stop us from feeling so superior to others, from criticizing others and only noticing their faults. Because even though it's the case that there appear to be differences between beings, that some appear to be good and others appear to be bad, some appear to have more qualities and others appear to have more faults, all of these are just mere appearances. Because the basic nature of every single sentient being is equally the Buddha nature. So realizing this, we free ourselves from the tendency to criticize and to put ourselves above others. To realize that our nature is the Buddha nature is to realize that in essence we are completely perfect. There is not the slightest flaw or problem or error in the basic nature of who we are. And just as that is the case with us, so it is the case that the basic nature of everyone else is the same. Everyone's essential nature is perfect from the very beginning. It doesn't have the slightest blemish or problem with it. So realizing that everyone is completely perfect will not only free us from the flaw of criticizing them, but also will cause an incredible pure vision of others to arise. And that's a great benefit. And knowing that our nature is the Buddha nature also changes the way that we relate to the mental afflictions such as anger and pride and jealousy, because we come to understand that these mental afflictions cannot touch, cannot alter in any way the basic nature of mind, which is clear light and is without any flaw. And we begin to understand that these mental afflictions are merely temporary. They are adventitious, meaning that they are not of the nature of mind. And so when we know that, we come to know that in fact these things are not real. They are not of the basic nature of reality. They are merely passing clouds. They're like clouds in the sky. They're like the other kinds of minerals you find in gold ore that can just be refined away quite easily to leave the pure gold remaining. So we no longer cling to these mental afflictions as being real in any way once we know that our true nature is the Buddha nature. And furthermore, once we know that our nature is the Buddha nature, then we no longer deny the reality of the situation, which is that the basic nature of mind is clear light, free of any stain. This is its actual abiding way. And when we know that, then we will stop denying what really is. We will stop denying that the Buddha nature exists. And so gaining confidence that our nature is the Buddha nature frees us from this flaw as well. And we will also come to understand how it is that the appearances of samsara appear and the appearances of nirvana appear. Because the basic nature of our mind is this radiant clarity. And yet not realizing that through the power of ignorance, what if this clear light appears as the confused appearances of samsara and everything that goes along with that. However, once we realize its nature, once the fleeting stains are cleared away, then the appearances, the confused appearances of samsara are transformed into the pure appearances of nirvana, the appearances of the enlightened bodies and the wisdoms and the Buddha realms and so forth. And so we lose our ignorance. We shed our ignorance as to the nature of samsaric appearance, the cause of these appearances, and the cause of the appearances of nirvana, once we know that the ground of everything is the Buddha nature.
대답하고 고급 천만의 캡슐단 천만의 조회인 양이인 나서 산재주 공방 조설 대신은 조절지 내 기발을 조절지 내는 이게 지금 내는 담배 추적발라 칼레카고 요 말에 내 라우이 추적발라 가와탄 또와요.
We will understand how it is that the confused appearances of samsara arise, and we will understand how it is that once one is liberated from ignorance, the pure appearances of nirvana arise. And so understanding how the state of confusion appears and how liberation occurs, we will have a great deal of confidence and delight in practicing the Dharma. We will greatly enjoy practicing on the path of Dharma. It will make us happy. So our basic nature is the Buddha nature. That's what's really there. And everything else that appears in terms of the five aggregates or skandhas and the sources of consciousness or ayatanas and the potentials or dhatus, all of these things which are divisions in the things which comprise the individual, different ways of classifying what makes up an individual, all of these things which appear are in fact just like dreams, like illusions, like water moons, like mirages, like movie appearances. They appear, but they are not real. And this is the certainty that we will come to gain. All of these examples are examples of empty forms. They are examples of things which can appear even while not existing in any substantial way. And they make it easy for us to understand how it is that things which we think are real can be the same, can be just mere appearances of things with no essence. And since they help us to know that, then the Buddha gave many, many examples of empty forms. The problem only happens when we take the aggregates, the skandhas and the dhatus and the ayatanas, these things which comprise the individual, when we take them to be the self. When we look at these things and we think that they are me, we take them to be real. We take them to be I. And when that happens, we suffer greatly as a result of the mental afflictions that come from that basic ego clinging. However, once we can realize that the fundamental nature of these is in fact the great expanse, then we relax into a state that is very open and spacious and without any problems at all.
다들 제 세단 남긴 남이 인데 그양 바양데 이는 양 그양 바양이 말 하마로 마히데 근데 덴바리 히데 갈든 나와 마소이샤 마소
In short, our basic nature is this expanse. It is the expanse of the present moment of mind. It is the expanse of who we really are on the inside. And yet, not realizing that, it appears that there are all of these different types of contradictory things. And we cling to the differences which we create and fabricate as being real. And this is what causes us all kinds of problems.
Kayan Bayan Munyan Re. Manam de Nama de Kayan Bayan Munyan Yinaya. Mo Maiki Balati de. Then Garden Nama Nato Shate, Koto Bushan. Jun Sin Karas and Garden Nama Yarana, Kayan Yamara, Koto Puyo. Then Manam Moshin and Garda to Zurang Indian Mado Bato Balati de Kayan Bayan Munyan. Manam Moshin into the Kashi Nangala.
That the appearances, everything that appears in this life is of the nature of the expanse, the Dharma Dhatu, that the nature of mind is in fact the Buddha nature. These are explanations that are in accord with the way that the Buddha taught in the sutras on the Buddha nature. They're in accord with the treatise, which is called the Gyulama, the highest in the continuum of Mahayana teachings. They are in accord with the protector Nagarjuna's text called the Praise of the Dharma Dhatu. And if we can realize this, then everything is open and spacious and relaxed. If we don't realize it and instead we take things to be real, then things are not relaxed, they're the opposite. We get very tense and anxious because we think things are real. It's like dreaming. If you know that it's a dream, then the appearances appear to you in a very different way than if you don't know it. In fact, the basic nature of the appearances is that they are naturally open and spacious, but because we don't know that we're dreaming, we relate to them in a way where we think they're real and things become very tight. However, once we know that it's a dream, then we can enjoy all of these things which we know are not real, which we know are just mere appearances, in a very open and spacious way. We can fly in the sky. If we want to sing and dance on the earth, we can sing and dance. We can arrange things very easily and in a relaxed way once we have this knowledge of the nature of the things that appear. In the beginning of his text called The Praise of the Dharma Dhatu, the protector Nagarjuna uses many examples to demonstrate how it is that the nature of mind is the Buddha nature, clear light. And among these examples, the most extraordinary are the examples of a flame that's burning within a clay vase. And also the example of sapphire that's blazing but covered over by a grosser stone. And when actually teaching about the expanse, Nagarjuna turns his attention to the 12 sources of consciousness and teaches that each and every one of the nature of these 12 is of the nature of Dharma Dhatu. And so the I, source of consciousness, the source of consciousness that is form, the source of consciousness that is the ear, the source of consciousness that is sound, the source of consciousness that is the nose, the source of consciousness that is an odor, the source of consciousness that is the tongue, the source of consciousness that is what is tasted, the source of consciousness that is the body, the source of consciousness that is what is felt by the body, and the source of consciousness that is mind, the mental consciousness, and the source of consciousness which are the phenomena which appear to that mental consciousness. All of these 12 are of the nature of Dharma Dhatu. The reason that is given why all of these things are in fact of the nature of Dharma Dhatu is that when we don't analyze them, then certainly they appear to be real. They appear to be real, and we think that they are real. We think that they are as they appear. But once we analyze, what we find is that none of them really exist. And one reason for that is that when we analyze anything that is composed of form, we find that it is in fact just made up of smaller particles. And when we analyze these smaller particles, they are made of smaller ones, and we can't find anything that inherently exists. We can't find one tiny, tiny particle even that is really existent. And so these things are just like dream appearances. They are appearances of things which do not really exist at all. And their nature is the expanse, which is open and relaxed. And so the outer sources of consciousness, the things which appear to the consciousness, like form and so forth, in their nature transcend matter. They transcend being made of any substantial particles. And so their nature is the open and relaxed expanse. And since the nature of what is outer is the expanse, then the nature of the inner sources of consciousness, the I and so forth, also must transcend being made of matter, transcend any type of particles. And therefore, the nature of these two as well is the open and relaxed expanse.
Sedra mabe lola zuma dutin chami dembar ke lembare zuma dutin chami da chiba kiji chami ke lembe se na dutin ke lembe dode be lola tinchin da ranchin ye le tinchin to ka re rang mo ma do bare ranchin de ne da ge ranchin de dembar ke lembare tin se na tin sedra mabe da dode be lola se dum ke lembe so
if we were to connect this type of explanation with the way that the different Buddhist tenets explain things, then first we would look at the explanation offered by the Vaibhashika or particularist school. What the particularist school says is that the tiniest particle, which is perceived, the partless particle, is something which truly exists. And the tiniest moment of consciousness, which is so small that it is indivisible, the counterpart to this partless particle, also exists. And if we look at the explanation of the Sutra school, the Sautrantika, then what they say is that there are two different ways of looking at things. First, there is the what is called the specifically characterized object, the thing which is actually perceived, and that really exists, they say. What they say does not exist is the abstract image of that specifically characterized phenomenon, which appears to the thinking mind. So they differentiate between these two. And so in short, these two schools both assert that matter exists. The particularist school says that there is this tiniest partless particle out there that is real, and the Sutra school says that there is this substantially, specifically characterized entity, which is the basis for thoughts, which is the basis to which names are given, and that this entity truly exists as well.
Tenek doktor hatan geba geyin bir kavle tene tene batu mama tanda dete chami ke lamar se da tinsan tene batu dete chami yan ke lenu lo sanzo ke tene da ge ke ne ma ta ne ba na to yi so di se ne se do ji ji ke so de so ka ke ne tene ba da yan ke ba yo ma sa san ba do den to ge do ge mu do che ran so ka ke da ma sa
This 20th century has been a time of incredible scientific inquiry into the nature of matter. And before it was the case that scientists uniformly thought that there was in fact some fundamental particle of matter which could not be divided any further, that truly existed. And this would be in harmony with the view of the particularist school. But nowadays there is some debate about that. Not all scientists agree. Some may say that there is, and some may say that there isn't. And also with regard to the view of the particularist school, some scientists may think that there is some basis of imputation, some specifically characterized object which actually does exist, and some may not agree. And therefore, we can see that these two schools' views are in some ways harmony with the ways in which scientists think. This is Rinpoche's opinion about the matter, but he encourages us all to investigate for ourselves into this, because among you all, there are probably some who have studied a lot of science, who know these things very well, and others who haven't can read the books about the views of the physicists and see what they say, and so we can all come to our own conclusions about this. The Mahayana philosophical schools do not assert the existence of outer objects. They do not believe that there is some fundamental particle of matter which is indivisible. They do not believe that there is some basis of imputation, some specifically characterized object that actually exists. They do not assert that there is truly existent matter. If we look at things from the perspective of the mind-only school, the Chittamatra, what they say is that everything which looks like it's on the outside, forms, sounds, smells, tastes, and things we touch, all of these are projections of our own habitual tendencies, just like things that appear in dreams. They're exactly the same. And since they are just projections of our own habitual tendencies, they are confused appearances. And since they are confused appearances, they do not inherently exist. What is perceived does not inherently exist as some object that is separate or cut off. And since there is no perceived object, then the perceiving mind, the mind which focuses on these outer objects, cannot exist either. And so we see that, in fact, reality is empty, according to the mind-only school, of the duality of there being some perceived object and some perceiving subject. What is left over, then, is mere consciousness that is aware in a non-dual way. This is described as being self-awareness. It is described as mere clarity, mere lucidity. And this non-dual consciousness is ultimate truth.
Koro parpa shirab je parut de seba simbe gomba tinlam bepar seba ko oma ranje batar do sena tene seta nange chu tamje jegdan tumara yinlin debare jegdan tumara yinlin debe sena tene
Moving to the explanations of those who base their views on the Buddha's teachings in the second turning of the wheel of Dharma, the first is the Svatantrika Madhyamika, the middle way autonomy school. And proponents of this school's view analyze all phenomena in samsara and nirvana in exactly the same way. Whether they be an inner entity or an outer one, they are all equally things which are neither one nor many. In their nature, whatever it is, it transcends being either one thing or being many things. And since you cannot classify it as being either one or many, then you must say that it does not really exist. It is just a mere appearance of something which has no essential nature, like appearances in dreams or illusions. The way that this reasoning works, that shows that things are neither one nor many, is that we cling to things as being one. Whatever we look at, we have this thought that it is one unitary entity. But in fact, we can see once we analyze that that's not the case, because whatever phenomenon it might be, it is composed of an incredible number of parts. In fact, there's no one thing there, there are just a bunch of parts. Just like the hand, if we take that as an example. And since there is not one thing, there can't be many either, because each one of those parts you can analyze in the exact same way. And so, even though we cling to things as being real, as having some existence, since they are neither one nor many, we must conclude that in fact they don't really exist at all. A movie, appearances in movies are a very good example of how things appear but really don't exist. Because whatever appears in a dream, it looks like it's something that's really there, but in fact it's not. It's not something that's one thing. It's not something that's many things. If you try to say that it's one thing, it just breaks down into parts, and all of those parts break down into parts. And so you can't find anything that's really there at all. Those who were the greatest commentators on the Buddha's intention of that he expressed in the teachings of the second turning of the wheel of Dharma were the followers of the middle way consequence school, the Prasangika Madhyamika. And the view of the middle way consequence school is that whatever phenomenon it might be in samsara, nirvana, whether it's on the inside or the outside, its basic nature transcends all conceptual fabrications about what it is. Fabrications of existence, non-existence, reality, or falsity, all of these are transcended by the basic nature of phenomena. Because the basic nature of phenomena transcends all conceptual fabrications. And so what the consequence school does is to refute any attempt, any conceptual attempt to describe the nature of reality, but they do not assert anything in its place. They do not even make an assertion that reality is free of conceptual fabrications. They refute all others' fabrications and let it stand just as it is. The protector Nagarjuna said, empty, not empty, and so forth the four. Where are these in the expanse of peace? Emptiness, not emptiness, both emptiness and not emptiness, or neither emptiness nor not emptiness. These are the four possibilities. Where are any of these possibilities in the expanse of peace? Following the protector Nagarjuna came many great scholar yogis in the consequence school's tradition, the glorious Chandrakirti, the Bodhisattva Shantideva, and all of them refuted everyone else's positions and made no argument in their place.
되는 걸로 숨바 중걸로 숨바 내게 인구 노대남도 공부한 데와 이제 특별히 믿을 남았다. 공부 노력이 취지 있는 떠가나서 같대다래. 되네 단다. 내록대 생제 내록대 공장 잡는다. 그러자 잡는 바. 되네 인다를 그 예매 봐. 사동 예매도.
And then there were those who commented on the teachings of the Buddha in the third turning of the Wheel of Dharma, most notably the texts called the Gyulama, the highest in the continuum of Mahayana teachings, and the praise of Dharmadhatu by the protector Nagarjuna. And in these commentaries, it is explained that the basic nature of reality from awareness. So if we look at the explanation of the basic nature of mind, the Buddha nature, through the lenses of this examination of the views of the Buddhist tenets, then the Buddha nature, what the Buddha nature is, becomes much more clear. And that's why Rinpoche has felt that it would be good to go through these different schools' views in this brief way. The luminosity, that is the basic nature of mind, the Buddha nature, contains within it the seeds, the potentials for the development of compassion and wisdom. And since it contains the seed for the development of compassion, then we can cultivate that compassion. We can cultivate it and cause it to grow until it becomes limitless, until it becomes all the way until it becomes the completely limitless compassion of the Buddha. We can continue to cultivate that seed of compassion and cause it to grow and grow even further. And similarly with the seed of wisdom, since the Buddha nature contains the seed of wisdom, we can listen to the teachings and understand them. We can reflect on the meaning of the teachings and thereby cut through all of our doubts. We can meditate on the teachings and gain experience of the nature of reality. We can cause our wisdom to grow and grow until it too becomes the limitless wisdom of the Buddha. Once we know that we can practice in this way on the path to attaining enlightenment, to becoming a Buddha ourselves, then it follows that we might ask the question, well, what is the Buddha really? What does it mean to be a Buddha? What it means to be a Buddha, in short, is it means that one has completely perfected one's compassion. It can't get any better. And one has completely perfected one's wisdom. One's wisdom cannot grow any more. When these two are taken to their completely ultimate state, then that is what it means to be enlightened.
Sanjay,
In the Mahayana, since we are all followers of the Mahayana, we have the strong intention, the strong wish to attain enlightenment. But this is not a competition. We're not in trying to be better than anyone or be better than the Buddha even, because what we will understand is that what it means to become enlightened means to perfect one's compassion and to perfect one's wisdom. That's what it's all about. Since this is the definition of Buddhahood, to completely perfect one's wisdom and compassion, then we can see that sentient beings can in fact become enlightened by doing just that, by bringing their compassion and wisdom to their ultimate states. Sentient beings can too become enlightened Buddhas. It's true that even before we become enlightened, we will become what are called the noble bodhisattvas, the exalted realized beings who reside on the bodhisattva grounds, the bhumis. And we will be able to perform in that stage great benefit for others. And we might think, well, that might be good enough just to be a noble bodhisattva. But what we have to remember is that if we become enlightened, then we can perform the benefit of others in an incredibly vast way, in a way that never ceases. And that's why it's important to get all the way there. There are those bodhisattvas who reside on the 10th ground, such as Manjushri and Vajrapani and Dhyanezi, the 8 heart disciples of the Buddha. And residing on the 10th bodhisattva ground, they perform incredible benefit for others. And yet in the future, they too will become enlightened. They too will become Buddhas, because there's even more that they can do. Even as how much they are doing, there is still a little bit more that they can do. We can also look at the example of the noble Tara, Drolma, the liberator. An incredible number of eons ago, she was the ordinary girl. She was the princess Yeshe Dawa, moon of wisdom. And at that time, she gave rise to incredible loving kindness and compassion for others. She developed the supreme mind turned towards enlightenment, bodhicitta, and she began to do things for others in an incredible way, accumulate merit by practicing generosity and all different kinds of things to be a benefit to others. And she practiced that throughout countless lifetimes until she too became an exalted being, a noble bodhisattva, and was able to begin emanating many emanations of herself, who all have been of incredible benefit to others, and become herself an object of great veneration and praise. The noble Tara made the extraordinary commitment to always appear in the form of a woman and to attain enlightenment in the form of a woman as well. And so this is what she does. She constantly emanates in the form of a woman, being of benefit to others. And when she attains enlightenment, she will do so in a woman's form. She appeared in the realm of humans once in Tibet in the form of the one who was known as Machik Labdrin. Machik Labdrin, as soon as she was born, she had three eyes. She had the wisdom eye in the middle of her forehead as well. And as soon as she was born, she levitated into the sky and said, Hari Nisa, ah, ah, ah. From her middle eye emanated immeasurable rays of light. She danced and sang in the sky, and everybody knew right away that she was an emanation of Tara. Machik Labdrin's father was a local chieftain. She was from a very prominent family in the region. And it happened that when she was born, rainbows came and melted straight into the roof of the house where she was born. And this was another indication, a miraculous indication, that in fact something truly marvelous was happening. And similarly, when there comes along a truly remarkable woman practitioner, a yogini whose mind is incredibly noble, who performs great benefit for others, who has great realization, then the Tibetans immediately recognize her as an emanation of Tara. If we look at how it happened with Chenrezi, Avalokiteshvara, then first he was an ordinary being. He was a monk whose name was Lodur Tenpa, and he meditated on compassion until the point when he was able to receive from all of the Buddhas the empowerment of compassion. When he received this empowerment, he was transformed into the noble being called Chenrezi, the one who sees all. And from that time until the present, He still has the same name. He still looks on all beings with great compassion. And now the noble Chenrezig has become like a Yidam deity, and he emanates in many different forms with either two arms or four or six or a thousand, in many different emanations as he appear in his form as a divine being. And this is our path as well. We will practice on this path. We will become like the noble Tara and the noble Chenrezig, bodhisattvas on the exalted crowns, the bhumis. And then when even the tiniest of our obscurations are completely cleared away, we will attain the state of complete and perfect enlightenment. If we think, well, it's going to take a long time for me to become enlightened, and if all during all that time I just have to keep doing nothing but helping others, aren't I going to get burned out by that? Aren't I going to get tired by that? And no, we won't. And the reason why we won't is that we know that samsara, the entirety of appearance, is not real. It's just appearance and emptiness. And so it's very open and relaxed, no matter what is happening. And if, on the other hand, it was real, then there would be a reason for us to get tired. But since it's not, then we don't have to worry about it. The Buddha's taught the 16 types of emptiness, and one of these is the emptiness of what is not perceivable. And this teaches of the emptiness of the three times. It teaches, in fact, there's no such thing as time. Time isn't real. And the Buddha has taught this in order to help us get over our feeling of discouragement when we think that we have to practice on the path for three immeasurable eons before we can become enlightened. So, in fact, teaches that the three times, the past, the present, and the future, are really of the nature of equality. There's really no such thing as time at all. And furthermore, when we practice on the Mahayana path, we make the commitment to benefit every single sentient being. And when we think about that, then we start to think, well, wait a minute. Every single sentient being, there are limitless sentient beings. I can never help them all. And immediately we can get discouraged at the thought of having to be a benefit to every single sentient being. And that's why the Buddha taught the emptiness of the vast. The vast means the directions. And in fact, when we analyze, we find that there are no directions. There's no such thing as location. And since there's no such thing as location, then there can't be any such thing as really as the beings inhabiting any location. And so this is a remedy for our feeling discouraged at the thought of having to be of benefit to all these different beings who are all over the place, because we realize that in fact location doesn't really exist. The word bodhisattva in the Tibetan contains the syllable pa, which means a hero, a warrior. And one who is a bodhisattva is a warrior because bodhisattvas are not, they're not discouraged or disheartened by the fact that they're going to have to practice for such a long time, 3 immeasurable eons. They're not disheartened by the fact that they're going to have to be of benefit to every single sentient being. They're not afraid of doing whatever they have to do, giving away their own flesh and blood. And since they have, even if that's what's necessary, so since they have these types of fearlessness, they are called warriors, whether they are men or women. If they have these types of fearlessness, they are worthy of the name bodhisattvas. Bodhisattvas who are practicing on the first two paths, the paths of accumulation and of junction, are still ordinary beings, and they are also called by the name bodhisattva. They are called warriors, but in fact they do not truly become warriors until they become noble, exalted bodhisattvas, which means they have reached the path of seeing, the path of the direct experience of the nature of reality. This has been a brief explanation of the way that the Buddha nature pervades all sentient beings, and the way that the Mahayana philosophical schools explain the nature of reality. So beginning this afternoon, Rinpoche will explain to us the chapter on suchness from the text called The Ornament of the Mahayana Sutras, and he would like us all to get a copy of it now so that we can read it during the break. So now Rinpoche will give us the reading transmission, and in between the sessions it would be good if we could read this over to get a clearer understanding of
it. Dado tama dani dante ni nebar ne ni tini maga ni legi ni tene nawa ki tese thaba nawa tante ba. Ketan Tupa Sandi Kyo Yit Dunga Rangi Jisha Tomi Rangi Rangi Dunga Dunga Mi Teh Shuchya Rangi Teh Rangi Kene Mara Kyo Yodho Ma Kyo Ketan Kyo Teh Rangi Kansa Yopa Mato Mi Dunga 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 Namba Teh Kansa Dala Tantan Sute Kewa Ta Kewa Sene Chepar Teh Rangi Onjang Gheva Lena Sepa Ta Kewa Sebe Kewa Sabar Teh Rangi Sanjo Sambha Sunam Yiki Tien Taye Paru Sunam Vekhsan Chuda Sambha Kendo Namo Yiki Tungja Namba Jirga Jitinto Teyi Jirga Tanto Tungra Ne Tena Sipha Lame Yandani Tene Chuyi Ni Jem Tini Ta Trava Muso Ni Dita Vajra Tene Yemi Pane Lure Ne Tene Simta Maiba Yiro Lodan Dende Nibu Mire Ne Tene Dende Chuji Yandani Lodan Dende Mato Yiki To
Let's read this together.
Not existent, not non-existent, not the same, not different. It neither arises nor ceases, neither increases nor decreases. It is not purified anew. There is purification of the adventitious stains. These are the characteristics of genuine reality. The view of the self is not the self. It does not have the self's characteristics. The self does not exist in what is inferior. It does not have the same characteristics. The self does not exist apart from these two. So the view of self is a mistake. It is just a mistake that is cleared up on the path to liberation. It is just this confusion that makes individuals unable to realize an end to their suffering. Suffering is not perceived by wisdom, but by self-experience. Actually, is suffering. There is no suffering. It is just a phenomenon, and this phenomenon has no inherent nature, since people see directly that things arise in dependence upon causes and conditions. How could they believe that someone else created them? They do not see what exists, they see what does not. Oh, how much in the dark they are. In actual reality, there is no difference between peace and birth. However, it is taught that those who perform virtuous actions will stop taking birth and will attain peace. The bodhisattvas excellently gather and immeasurable accumulation of transcendent merit and wisdom. Since they have such certainty in their view, they know the causes of naming the images of objects, knowing that objects are mere expressions. They abide perfectly in mind, which alone appears as outer objects. Then they realize as direct experience dharma to free of any sign of duality. They are aware that nothing apart from mind exists. Then they realize that mind itself does not exist. With their great intelligence, aware of non-duality, they abide in Dharma Dhatu. Vatu, absent subject or object, with their brilliant minds and through the power of their non-conceptual primordial wisdom, they always remain in complete equipoise. Through this they clear away the thicket of faults which remain. It is like a great medicine, eliminating poison from the body. The root of the genuine Dharma's teachings, excellently presented by the Mighty One, is Dharma Dhatu. Within it they place their minds, they have stable awareness that movements of mind are merely conceptual, and they swiftly cross to the far shore of the ocean of qualities.
Thank you.